Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of January, 2016. Welcome to episode 8 of our new ongoing podcast concept. And that concept is to just have a chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes it pretty much the books I read during January. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, which I regularly repost through Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not spoilers for this podcast at all, since those are just lists. And here, you'll find a little more review, some critique, maybe even some discussion. But first, a little feedback on last month's episode, which was also the year-end episode. Iowa's Joe Crawford said that he enjoys hearing what I'm reading, and he wished both me and Emily Happy New Year's. He also gave a counterpoint to my complaint about the Micronauts miniseries changing paper stock during the run. I have a quick question. Is it possible that the issue is different paper quality because it was a newsstand edition? I believe Image and other companies use different paper in newsstand versus direct market editions. Glossy for direct market and standard for newsstand. I immediately replied to that with, "That could certainly be the case, Joe." And in the few weeks to follow, I actually found some of those later Micronauts issues in quarter bins, and they were, in fact, on glossy paper. So he was exactly correct. Iowa's Kyle Benning also wrote in, asking if my convergence love has led me to read the Lois and Clark title by Dan Jurgens and art by Lee Weeks. If you like the Convergence two-parter with the pregnant Lois, I think you'll enjoy this new series. Issue number 3 hit the stands last week. Canadian Rob Lance replied to Kyle, agreeing that that was a good series. Along with Batman Europa, this is giving us a true essence of our beloved heroes. I replied to both fine gentlemen that I'm trade-waiting on that one, along with Batmite and Bizarro. But I have certainly heard great things. Both Rob and the Sutherlands were grateful that they were able to share the Listener of the Year award, and nobody seemed to mind the percentages of the award that they each earned, except for Ruth Sutherland, who thought that maybe Darren's 5% was a little generous. That episode's Facebook post was shared by the Sutherlands and by Chris Ivey, who I used to say was of the myth-making ETC podcast, but now, sadly, I have to say formerly of the myth-making ETC podcast. Gonna miss that one, Chris, but I will still be listening to you on the Geek Brunch Retrocast, so keep the Wally West stuff coming. As always, to everyone, thanks for the feedbacks. And now on to the books that I read last month. And as I do in these episodes, I'm categorizing the books that I cover. And first are the issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances. The homework books. Secret Origins 27. Emily and I are appearing on an upcoming episode of Ryan Daly's Secret Origins podcast, covering this issue, which tells the joint origins of the magical father and daughter team of Zatara and Zatanna. That will be episode 27 of his show, Secret Origins, which should be out around the time this episode comes out, maybe the week before, maybe the week after. And then 4 episodes of the Quarterbin podcast that aired in January. I read Tailgunner Joe 6. This one I just pulled out of the Quarterbins at random. It was a title that I'd never heard of before, which evidently put me in the same position as many of the listeners to that episode. Also read X-Files number 0, that was the official adaptation of the pilot episode for the original series. Again, a quarter bin episode that went out just a couple weeks ago to coincide with the return to the air of the TV series. Also picked up at Half Price Books for the magical price of 25 cents. The first issue of Watson and Holmes from a few years ago. I'd heard good things about it when it came out. The gist of it is that it's a reimagining of Doyle's characters as African-American gentlemen in modern-day Harlem. As soon as I read it, I had an idea of the fellow Holmesian I want to talk to about this one. So nothing is set yet, but I hope to cover this on the Quarterbin Show later this year. And for listening to podcasts, I read Adventures of Superman 521, Action 708, Superman Man of Steel 42, and Superman 98. These are 25-cent books that I've purchased over time to follow along with Michael Bailey and Jeffrey over on From Crisis to Crisis. For details, listen to them talk about these books on episodes 198 and 199. This batch of issues wrapped up the Babe storyline, the vampire rock star chick. There was also a Toy Man story, a follow-up featuring Cat Grant regarding, well, due to potential Supergirl TV show spoilers, I'll not go into detail. A Rose and Thorn story was in there, and a guest appearance by Big Barda and Mr. Miracle, as well as the ongoing Shadow Dragon subplot. And I do admit, I am kind of getting sick of long-haired Superman. Out of respect to Michael Bailey, I won't describe the exact hairstyle. Let's just call it long hair, okay? I also read parts 1 and 2 of the Sins of the Father storyline from Trekker by Ron Randall. This introduced a lot of aspects to Mercy St. Clair's backstory and origin. This story was covered on episode 13 of the excellent podcast Trekker Talk. Then on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC. And we have three this month now that Gotham by Midnight is over. DC Bombshells number 8. Now we're getting somewhere plot-wise, while not sacrificing the character moments that have been the highlight of the book so far. We have an army of the dead arising, that's always good, both on land and in the sea. And what we have in this issue is a lot of backstory on the Russian Stargirl and her English father. In terms of new Easter eggs, we have Enigma as a butler, but the highlight scene is Wonder Woman running into the head of the undead army, the Baroness Paula von Gunther. I continue to dig this series, really like where it's heading. Starfire 8. Fortunately, this is the end of the Dick Grayson subplot. He has left Key West, giving Corey a chance to spend quality time kissing the sheriff's brother, Saul. Corey and the sheriff and the other alien chick in town, Atlee, are planning a trip to Atlee's homeland in the center of the Earth. And at the end of the issue, something is glowing at the bottom of Corey's swimming pool. She's convinced that it's something wonderful, but I'm not so sure. Constantine the Hellblazer, number 8. This one takes place totally at Papa Midnight's club, Club Midnight, and is super weird and super disturbing also. In the story, the demon Neron has been squeezing out Papa Midnight in terms of running the whole evilly demonic side of New York. You know, those New York values. Their plan to infiltrate the club without Neron noticing? Yeah, that doesn't go so well. So stay tuned in this episode for more Underworld Unleashed talk. But it was really good timing to be reading a Neron return just after reading Neron's starring role from the past. And in a nice touch, Constantine obliquely referenced Underworld Unleashed, something about Neron making a bunch of deals for souls a few decades ago. And on to the regular reading that I did. I have never read any of Kurt Busiek's Astro City books, although I've heard nothing but good about them. Part of it is the somewhat confusing nature of just how the issues have been released, different publishers, a variety of miniseries, so just knowing what order to read these in has been too much for me to think about. But I saw a handful in the cheap bins recently, thought there's a good chance to dip my toes into what I understand are some very well-regarded books. These are all from the 1996 series, so the second volume, which started at Image and then migrated to DC, keeping the numbering. You can maybe see where cataloging and organizing might be a bit confusing. But all three of these come from the series after DC had picked it up. So it's Astro City 16, The Story of a Hero from the Barrio, El Hombre, and how his exploits were not enough to win the heart of his love. and a sad, sad fall from grace. Astro City 17, a really enjoyable story of a pretty dumb supervillain, the Mock Turtle. At least a villain who's pretty easy to take advantage of. And an evil red-headed temptress does just that. And then, of course, he is so dumb that he blunders into messing up her well-laid plans and has to flee her evil red-headedness. Astro City 22, this one featured a stuntman-slash-actor who plays a hero in a soap opera and through a few lucky breaks actually becomes a hero, at least for a short time. But he realizes quickly that he's in over his head as he becomes not just a celebrity hero, but also target number one for villains trying to make a name for themselves. So his buddies on the cast and the crew of the soap opera make sure he's taken down a few pegs and he can go back to his relatively anonymous life. All three of these are great stories. And that's just a reaction after coming to these books with high expectations. I know the reputation Astro City has, that a lot of people really, really like it. And just from these three random 50-cent or dollar books, whatever they were, I can totally see why. Really interesting stuff. Just superhero comics from a little off-kilter perspective. And that really makes them stand out. Baker Street Graffiti. I'm a big fan of this series, which was a black and white series from the late 80s. An alternate universe with steampunk and goth cultures mixed and matched, with a female Sherlock Holmes analog and her American roommate as the Watson. I reread the 10 issues a few years ago, and it still holds up. Anyway, this volume was a special produced a year or so after the series ended, with a few short story reprints from collections, as well as a bunch of poster images and concept art for potential calendars and t-shirts and merchandise that never went anywhere. Well worth the, I think this one was a 50-center, from Half Price Books. Fusion 1, 2, and 4. I've mentioned a few times the Labor Day project that Emily and I did of organizing and arranging our comic book collections. In addition to working a number of stacks of purchased comics into the collection, I also removed some books from the collection. Mostly books that didn't just interest me anymore, or series with holes in the collection that I had no interest in filling. Into which category Fusion falls. This was a black and white sci-fi book written by a sci-fi novelist, Stephen Barnes. The story was pretty standard, a ragtag crew during odd jobs earning enough money to keep their ship flying. Nothing too revolutionary, and obviously it never moved me enough to find number 3, or number 5, which ended the first arc. These issues also included very short 3 to 5 page stories featuring Dr. Watchstop by Ken Macklin. Each of these was self-contained, told a whole story, and like a good short story, ended with a punch of some kind. Those backups were by far the best part of each of these three issues. Sludge, number 8. There will be an Ultraverse comic covered, upcoming, on the Quarterbin, but not this book. So I had it lying around, and I said to myself, Professor Allen, you should read that Sludge book. It was very 90s, featuring both Lord Pumpkin and Bloodstorm. The good thing about having Bloodstorm in the book was that it made the guy with the pumpkin for a head seem not all that crazy. I also read Ultra Force 9 and 10 from mid-1995. By this point, Malibu was working with Marvel, perhaps the purchase had even fully gone through. And these ones have some Marvel crossover stuff going on. Number 9 was almost exclusively a fighty-fight issue, a big brawl. And it was all right. Definitely 90s-ish in the art. But, like I said, it was all right. Number 10 was almost as big a fighty-fight issue, with a little dimension hopping here and there, and the big guest appearance of Loki towards the end, leading into the official Avengers Ultra Force crossover. And then, as a change of pace, Walt Disney's Comics and Stories 462 from 1979. this one was purchased from World's Greatest Comics for the awesome price of one shiny quarter. The lead story was pretty good, Donald Duck becoming a detective and protecting a jewel owned by Uncle Scrooge from thievery by the Beagle Boys. The backup stories, though, not as strong. I don't care about Scamp, and the Goofy story wasn't all that great either. Maybe because it was another crime story as well, too similar to the much better opening story. So overall, this issue is a little on the meh side, as the kids these days say. Shazam! The New Beginning number 2 of 4. I think I got this one in a pack from a listener, or maybe as an extra from Kyle Benning when I bought some stuff from him on eBay. Maybe from someone else, I don't remember. Anyway, it's Roy and Dan Thomas writing, Tom Mandrake on art, so it was pretty good. The best part was that when Black Adam arrives, before he has become used to the world, he speaks in hieroglyphs. That's a nice touch, and it's a touch that really can only be done in comics. So despite this being issue number 2, I had no problem following the story, and the fight scenes between Captain Marvel and Black Adam were pretty great. In general, I'm not a huge Shazam fan, especially when he's part of the mainstream DC continuity. I like him off in his own world, looking like C.C. Beck intended him, hanging with Mr. Talkie Tawny and all that. But again, this one was not too bad. And any time I find books written by my internet buddy and former guest on the Quarterbin podcast, Paul O'Connor, I pick them up. He was on episode 30, by the way. And he wrote a couple of Lensman miniseries back in the early 90s for Eternity Comics, a black and white publisher back in the day. There was another mini that Paul did not write that I picked up that were new, and I have good memories of that. But I saw this one at Half Price Books, the first issue of his Secret of the Lens mini, again written by Paul. It was a good first issue of father and son story, and it does set up the premise of there being something mysterious going on. So I'm keeping my eyes peeled for the other ones in the series. I'm a little more familiar with the Doc Smith stories than with the anime that these comics were based on, but it's epic sci-fi type of series, space opera, and I'd like to see where this story is going. Listener Rob Lance sent a care package a few months ago, and I'm still working my way through it, including reading All-Star Squadron Annuals 1 and 2. He sent 1, 2, and 3, and I read 3 a few months ago and talked about it. That's the one with Ian Carcool and the future U.S. presidents. That's a really good story. These two, they were fine, but not to that level of the prior one. Again, prior one for me reading it being Annual 3. Annual 2 included characters from Infinity Inc., and that helped make it interesting. And Annual 1 took a decent concept that the mentor figure for a number of the All-Stars was in fact the same guy, but then told a pretty boring story with what, again, could have been a potentially interesting concept. For more thorough reviews of those stories, of course, listen to the Tales of the Justice Society, Mike Bailey and Scott Gardner. From 2003, also read Plastic Man's 80-page annual, and this was a fun read. Plastic Man is a character I really dig, but that I can't say I've read a lot of, because he can also wear on me a little bit. But I enjoyed this collection a lot. The weakest stories were probably the first two, his first appearance, and then the first appearance of WYSIWYNKS, both from Police Comics, early 1940s. What I did like about these early stories was that his alter ego was a bad guy, and even after becoming Plastic Man, he was really using his prior connections to help the police. So I just thought that was a really interesting, unique take on a character, and I'm sure it's been done since, but that really stood out as an interesting concept. There is in here also a 2-page prose story about Plastic Man from the mid-40s, which is not great. And then we don't get another story until 1966, and there are two from that year. One is a Dial H story, where Robbie Reed's Dial turns him into Plaz, who he describes as a famous crime fighter from the past. I'm guessing that this was a backdoor pilot for the Plastic Man series, a testing out of the waters, because the next story in the collection, my favorite in the issue, was from about 6 months later. It's an Arnold Drake story with Gil Kane art from the brand new Plastic Man ongoing. And it's just a fun, energetic story. It has a bit of a Mad Magazine type of energy, with a crazy villain, Dr. Doom, a crazy plot, and Plastic Man defeating him in a crazy manner. I love that story, and I really like the last one, too, from 1976, which had Ramona Fraiden art. So again, energetic, fun, wacky, and wild. But that's about as much Plastic Man as I can take in one sitting. He can get repetitive, and I think the goofiness could become exhausting after a time, but I thoroughly enjoyed that 80-pager. All right, I'm going to take a break here, play a promo for an excellent podcast, and when we come back, talk about the trades and graphic novels and miniseries that I read.
Do you want to hear the origin of Superman or Batman? Of course not. You're listening to a Geek Culture podcast. You know the origins of Superman and Batman. You've always known them. Your unborn grandchildren know the origins of Superman and Batman. But what about Guy Gardner, Blue Beetle, or the Phantom Stranger? What about Firestorm, Sandman, or the Golden Age Fury? Those are just a few of the stories covered in the Secret Origins podcast, a review show dedicated to the Secret Origins comic published by DC in the 1980s. Each episode of the Secret Origins podcast features me, Ryan Daly, and an all-star collection of guest hosts revealing or revisiting the legends of the DC superheroes and villains. And if you're already sick of hearing my voice on this promo, the good news is at least 50% of the talking on the Secret Origins podcast is done by a terrific guest from the podcast and blogging community. So check out the Secret Origins podcast, available on iTunes and at secretoriginspodcast.wordpress.com.
And we're back. So here I'm going to talk about, again, trades, graphic novels, and miniseries that I read. I mentioned last episode how much I really enjoyed the Underworld Unleashed miniseries and the two tie-in issues that I had found. And I understand that a lot of these villain revamps didn't take, that they didn't last, but taking this event just as an event 20 years later, I really enjoyed it for what it was. Well, since then, in the last month or so, I've tracked down and read about 10 more of those tie-in issues. I have no idea what order makes sense for talking about these, so I'm going with alphabetical. Azrael, number 10. Okay, I was around during Nightfall, etc., so I know who Azrael is and the role he plays in Batman since the mid-90s. This story actually features not Azrael, not Jean-Paul Vallée, but instead a man who wants to take up the mantle of Azrael. He was defeated by Vallée earlier in the series, and I guess this sort of retcons that prior issue into Neron having made a deal with this character to keep him from dying. It's actually a pretty decent one-off in which Batman actually teaches this Azrael a lesson, and he actually appears to be a changed person by the end of the issue. Damage, 18. Well, before this, I had never read an issue of Damage before. And after this, I don't think I ever need to read an issue of Damage ever again. I know Underworld Unleashed was a DC event, but enough said. Detective Comics 692. In this one, Batman and Tim Drake Robin face a souped-up, Neron-powered spellbinder. It's written by Chuck Dixon, so no surprise, it's really good. Batman is a bit stumped about what's going on, and Oracle lets him know that, yes, a lot of weird things have been happening. New villains, old villains with crazy new powers. Eventually, Batman faces Spellbinder blindfolded to avoid the effects of her illusion-y powers, and along with Tim guiding him remotely, he is able to defeat her. I really enjoyed that story. Fate number 13. This is the first thing from this title I've ever read, and to be honest, I don't think it has the best reputation among fans of Dr. Fate. I liked two moments in this one in particular. Alan Scott, a Sentinel, and Fate are trying to close a passageway from the underworld, and they come face to face with a villain that Sentinel knows. Necron, Lord of the Unliving. At which point Fate comments, Everybody's the lord of something stupid in this business. That was funny. There's also a two-page denouement after accomplishing their mission. Sentinel talks about maybe misjudging fate, that he let his feelings for the Nelsons cloud his judgment. My guess is that this is the writer Lynn Kaminsky putting those words in Sentinel's mouth to address his readers. This is his attempt to convince them to give fate a chance. The title ended less than a year later, so I think that plea was a bit on the unsuccessful side. Green Lantern 69. Kyle Rayner was the star of the book in this era, and this one is completely an Underworld Unleashed issue. Kyle has gotten beaten up pretty good by Neron in the prior issue, who was upset that Kyle had turned down his offer of bringing Alex back to life. Yes, that's Alex of Women in Refrigerators fame. And then the last half of the issue is a fight against Purgatory, who accepted a deal from Neron and has become pretty darned powerful. Good fighting, good ending, good issue. Hawkman 26. This is an example of when these tie-ins worked well. The Hawkman supporting cast was heavily featured, but you also got a mostly standalone story about Katar taking on Scarecrow, who has gotten a power boost from Neron. A really nice read, again, enjoyable issue. Justice League America 105. This one had a lot of stuff going on, lots of characters, of course, but the key Underworld Unleashed moment is Blue Devil taking the fateful step of agreeing to Neron's deal and agreeing to vandalize a solitary electrical tower in the southwest. Neron calls it a harmless deed, and for a good cause. But having read the miniseries, I know there's a lot more to it than that. Wow, imagine that. You just can't trust Neron the demon when he's making a deal with you. Justice League Task Force 30. I'm realizing just how out of DC Comics I was by the mid-90s, because here's yet another title I'd never read before. This one came out right after The Ray, which I'll mention in a second. There were references to that story, so it's good that it worked out that I actually did read them in the right order, again, even though I'm not talking about them chronologically. The Neron part in this issue was mostly towards the end, so most of this was confirmation that I don't really need to read any more Justice League Task Force. The Ray, number 18. Another one that I've never read, but this one has a much better reputation, I think. And it's a pretty good story. It's basically Neron and Vandal Savage bargaining, debating, negotiating over the soul of the Ray. I like this. The art stood out. And this title is all over the cheap bins. If I can find a good run of issues of this, probably going to pick them up. Comics Reading Journal, an Underworld Unleashed podcast. Next up, a series from this episode's unofficial sponsor, Rob Lance of Comics Connection, Oakville, Ontario, Canada. This is the 5-issue Doctor Who mini from Titan Comics featuring the Ninth Doctor, as portrayed by Christopher Eccleston. His companions from the series, Rose Tyler and Captain Jack Harkness, round out the cast for this adventure. And in this mini, the crew gets caught up in a battle in the aftermath of the Time War. Two opposing factions, the Lect and the Unan, who are cool-looking centaurs, by the way, are both trying to step into the void left by the end of the Time War. They both want to be the new gatekeepers of time. There's some kidnapping, some time vortexes, temporal breaches. Good stuff, good story, and a pretty good resolution, too. And in our grand tradition here of talking about licensed books, I have to mention the artistic likenesses. And they're pretty good, and they're really consistent. That was Blair Shedd and Rachel Scott, by the way, on the art chores, and it was Kevin Scott who did the writing. Solid stuff. The Trenchcoat Brigade, 1-4. Great listener and friend of the network, Greg Arujo, sent issues 2-4 to us a while back, knowing that M and I had become fans of John Constantine. I was able to get number 1, and then I stashed the whole complete miniseries away to give Emily for Christmas, after I read them, of course. We have the team of Constantine, Phantom Stranger, Mr. E, and Dr. Occult. Of course, they're not an ongoing team, but an ad hoc group of mystics whose main trait that they have in common is their choice of outerwear. The plot was a bit confusing, a time travel thing featuring an ancestor of Constantine, long thought dead, who holds the key to saving the planet from the apocalyptic future that Mr. E has prophesied. Time travel stories can be a little bit wonky, and I'm not fully convinced that I know quite what was happening all along in this series. I did like that this ancestor is basically a Russian Cossack with a sword and a taste for vodka. So the idea that he's related to the Hellblazer, it all seemed very possible. The series has visions, bizarre dreamscapes, magical people, and wolves. What else does a miniseries need? And lastly, my first experiences with the new Marvel Star Wars line. Princess Leia 1 through 5. This was one of Marvel's first batch of new books, a miniseries written by Mark Waid with art by the Dodsons. Anytime I talk about a licensed property, I have to talk about likenesses. And it seems to me that the Dodsons were not trying to do an accurate late 1970s Carrie Fisher. Princess Leia in this one looks a lot more in some poses like Ron Randall's character, Mercy St. Clair in Trekker, for example, than she did the characters in the films. For one thing, her hair was loose most of the trade. Maybe that accounts for the lack of a close likeness, or maybe simply there were legal and rights issues involved. That is always a potential with situations like this. The story takes place right after the end of the first movie and is about Leia's role as a princess to a people whose planet just exploded. It is about finding other off-planet Alderaanians and moving forward with rebuilding that people, that civilization. So in a sense, it was a small story, not an epic, sprawling space opera, although there were multiple planets and the occasional skirmish with Imperial forces. And I really enjoyed this. I appreciated the character-building aspect of it, because it was not that sprawling, epic, sci-fi battle story. It probably works better here in trade than it may have as individual issues. Again, I enjoyed it. Darth Vader 1 through 6. This is the first arc of an ongoing by Kieran Gillen and Salvador LaRocca. The series tells the story of Darth Vader right after the first Death Star blew up real good. He is on the outs with the Emperor, managing to be the only person at his, shall we say, level in the organization to actually survive the explosion. I didn't necessarily like that this storyline included Jabba and Tatooine in the plot, but I guess that maybe Luke was just wrong in the first movie when he said that his planet was as far away from the center of the universe that any planet could be. That aside, there's a great new character in Dr. Aphra, who can best be described as a Darth Vader fangirl who comes into his service. There's a great exchange between them in, I think it's issue 4, where she recognizes that at some point Vader will have to kill her for the greater cause, which she believes in. He will have to make her disappear. And she just asks that he do it by surprise, no warning. By the lightsaber, please, she asks. But the key moment in terms of plot was the moment when Vader learned that the rebel pilot who flew the fateful trench run, was named Skywalker. I like that these series are trying to find the little moments that aren't clear in the movies and exploring those in the comics. And the trade ends with a bit of a change of heart for Vader, or at least a change of plans. I have a son. He will be mine. It will all be mine. Also read Kanan, The Last Padawan, 1 through 6. This is another of the Star Wars trades, another ongoing, but this one is based on the Rebels cartoon, of which I have seen very little. So for the most part, I was coming to this story as a blank slate. So it does not take place during the era of the original trilogy, where the other new Star Wars comics takes place. This one tells the story of the only Jedi survivor of Order 66, the Emperor's directive that all Jedi were to be executed. These issues tell the story, and we end up with him as the man Kanan, the smuggler and rabble-rouser from the Rebels cartoon. without knowing anything of the show, I was able to follow the story. It was well told. I never felt lost. I know enough Star Wars stuff, obviously, to understand the basic world that the story takes place in, and the general context for the story. I enjoyed it, except for the minor technicality that it was a first trade that ended on a total cliffhanger. Not a complete story with a bit of plot threads for the future, no. This story does not end, but just stops at a very dramatic, dangerous place for the lead character. And I'll be honest, that was kind of a bummer. Wow, I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, there was some pretty good stuff I read in January. I enjoyed Watson and Holmes, even with the high expectations I brought to that. Baker Street Graffiti was a total out-of-the-blue find, a book I never knew existed. That Plastic Man annual was a real treat, especially a couple of those stories. I liked the Underworld Unleashed tie-ins of JLA and especially Detective. And I liked the Darth Vader trade. But I think my favorites were the Astro City books. And specifically, I'll go with issue 17, the story featuring the Mock Turtle, as my favorite read for January. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. I expect the next episode of this show to be a lot shorter. For one thing, January had 5 Saturdays, so this is 5 blog posts worth of reading. Well, February only has 4. Also, January had those first 10 days or so when the semester hadn't started yet, so I had a little extra comic reading time the first part of the month, while February has no time off from work, not even a holiday. We can cross our fingers for some snow days, though. Those are always good for some heavy-duty comic book reading. So probably a little bit shorter show in February, but we'll find out for sure when that next episode comes out sometime in early March. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.